Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Excessive Force Standard of Proof Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On June 22, 2015, the Supreme Court decided Kingsley v. Hendrickson. The central question in this case was whether to prove an excessive force claim brought by a pretrial detainee against several jail officers, the detainee must show that the officers were subjectively aware that their use of force was unreasonable, or simply that the officer's use of that force was objectively unreasonable. In an opinion delivered by Justice Breyer, the Supreme Court held by a vote of 5-4 that the detainee needed to show only that the officer's use of force was objectively unreasonable. Justices Kennedy, Ginsburg, Sotomayor, and Kagan joined Justice Breyer's opinion for the court. Justice Scalia filed the dissenting opinion, in which Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Thomas joined. Justice Alito also filed the dissenting opinion. The judgment of the Seventh Circuit was vacated and the case remanded. To discuss the case, we have Joshua A. Skinner, who is an attorney at Fanning, Harper, Martinson, Brandt, and Kutchin, P.C., in Dallas, Texas. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Mr. Skinner.
In Kingsley v. Hendrickson, decided June 22nd, the Supreme Court in a 5-4 decision held that in order to prove an excessive force claim, a pretrial detainee must show that the jailer's use of force was objectively unreasonable. The court held that the jury instructions used in the case, and which resulted in a jury verdict in favor of the jailers, were in error because they also included a requirement that the plaintiff show that the officers were subjectively aware that their use of force was unreasonable. For background, Michael Kingsley was arrested on a drug charge and detained in a Wisconsin county jail prior to trial. As is common in county jails throughout the country, the same jail held both pretrial detainees, such as Kingsley, as well as individuals who had been convicted of relatively minor offenses for which they were sentenced to only a short period of incarceration. On the evening of May 20th, 2010, an officer performing a cell check noticed a piece of paper covering the light fixture above Kingsley's bed, which was a violation of the jail rules for various reasons. The officer told Kingsley to remove it, but he refused. Subsequently, other officers told Kingsley to remove it, and each time he refused. The next morning, the jail administrator told Kingsley to remove the paper, and again he refused. So ultimately, the jail administrator told Kingsley that the officers would remove it, but the Kingsley would be moved to a receiving cell in the interim. Shortly thereafter, four officers, including respondents in the case, Sergeant Hendrickson and Deputy Sheriff Degner, approached the cell and ordered Kingsley to stand, back up to the door, and keep his hands behind him. Not surprisingly, perhaps, he again refused. The officers, as a result, handcuffed him, forcibly removed him from the cell, carried him to the receiving cell, and placed him down, face down on a bunk with his hands cuffed behind his back. And that's when the part that really matters for the appeal happened in earnest. This is also where the stories differ between Kingsley and the officers a bit. The officers say that Kingsley resisted their efforts to remove his handcuffs. Kingsley denies that. They do agree that Sergeant Hendrickson placed his knee on Kingsley's back and, as the court puts it delicately, quote, Kingsley told him in impolite language to get off, end quote. They don't explain what that was. They all agree that Sergeant Hendrickson placed his knee on Kingsley's back and, as the court delicately put it, quote, Kingsley told him in impolite language to get off. Obviously, things kept going the way they were. There was this conflict between the officers and Kingsley. Kingsley claims that the officer slammed his head into the concrete bunk, but the officers deny this allegation. Ultimately, and this part the parties do agree on, Hendrickson directed Degner to stun Kingsley with a taser. Degner applied a taser to Kingsley's back for approximately 5 seconds. Then the officers left Kingsley handcuffed alone in the receiving cell. They returned 15 minutes later and removed Kingsley's handcuffs, apparently without incident. Kingsley filed a Section 1983 claim, arguing that Hendrickson and Degner used excessive force against him in violation of the 14th Amendment's Due Process Clause. The case ultimately went to trial, and the jury returned a verdict in favor of the officers. The dispute, however, relates to the jury instructions. Kingsley proposed a jury instruction designed for general Fourth Amendment excessive force claims. In other words, the type of excessive force claim that individuals and the general public might bring if the police use force against them. The officers, on the other hand, proposed jury instructions designed for Eighth Amendment cruel and unusual punishment claims, so claims brought by convicted individuals who are incarcerated as part of the terms of their conviction. The district court, however, didn't go with either of those proposals exactly, and instead came up with a sort of hybrid instruction. The district court's hybrid instruction required the jury to find that the officer's use of force was objectively unreasonable, like under the Fourth Amendment, but then also that the use of force had been applied recklessly, which was a sort of watering down of the standard under the Eighth Amendment. However, while ultimately the court melded aspects of the instructions for Fourth Amendment excessive force and Eighth Amendment cruel and unusual punishment claims, as I mentioned earlier, this case was actually brought under the 14th Amendment's Due Process Clause. So just to review, the Fourth Amendment protects the rights of people to be secure in their persons against unreasonable searches and seizures. More specifically, it restricts the degree or type of force the police may use in apprehending criminal suspects. And you might think, if a police officer sees a child picking somebody's pocket and then running off, the officer can't simply shoot the child in the back. That would generally be excessive force because the offense is relatively minor and there's no imminent physical danger to others from the pickpocket. On the other hand, an armed bank robber is shooting at police. The police can shoot back and attempt to kill the robber. The question in excessive force claims is the objective reasonableness of the officer's actions, not the subjective motivations of the officer, but what a reasonable officer might have done. Under the Eighth Amendment, it, among other things, prohibits the infliction of cruel and unusual punishments. Consequently, the Eighth Amendment only applies to individuals who have been convicted. It also seems to have an element of subjective intent. When you talk about, you know, the imposition of a cruel and unusual punishment, sounds like a subjective component there. Under the 14th Amendment, what we're really dealing with here, technically speaking, is the prohibition on the deprivation of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. The majority, in an opinion written by Justice Breyer and joined by Justices Kennedy, Ginsburg, Sotomayor, and Kagan, ultimately held that a pretrial detainee is only required to prove that the officer's use of force was objectively unreasonable and is not required to prove that the officer intended the excessiveness of the force. The court distinguishes two separate state of mind issues. The first one is simple, whether the defendant intends the action. In this case, there was no dispute on this question. There's no dispute that the officers intended the action of tasing Kingsley. It wasn't an accident. It wasn't that the taser accidentally went off, causing injury. And this is significant in the context of the Section 1983 claims trying to vindicate constitutional rights in that they don't cover accidental uses of force. The other aspect is, say, the intention as regards the possible excessiveness of the use of force. And this would include some sense of the purpose of the use of force. However, drawing from the Fourth Amendment excessive force jurisprudence, the court concluded that a pretrial detainee, like Kingsley, like anyone who is not incarcerated, is only required to prove that the use of force was objectively unreasonable. The court rejected the argument that such a plaintiff must also prove that the officer intended that excessiveness. However, drawing from Eighth Amendment jurisprudence, which prohibits cruel and unusual punishment, the officers argued that the court should require that the plaintiff prove that the officer intended the excessiveness. In support of using Eighth Amendment jurisprudence, the officers argued that the fact of incarceration is a, quote, game changer. That is, that pretrial detainees should be treated under the same standard as convicted persons because they are all incarcerated frequently together. The main dissenting opinion, written by Justice Scalia and joined by Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Thomas, generally agreed with the officers in lumping pretrial detainees with convicted individuals, but also specifically limited its opinion to the fact that the case is a 14th Amendment case and not a Fourth Amendment case. Similarly, in Justice Alito's separate dissenting opinion, he argues that the court should have dismissed the appeal precisely because the court has not decided the underlying Fourth Amendment issue. This raises some uncertainty about the significance of the dissent. that none of the dissenting opinions, neither of them, addresses what would be the appropriate standard if the case had been brought by Kingsley under the Fourth Amendment as an unreasonable seizure rather than under the 14th Amendment Due Process Clause, may or may not indicate that there is actually less disagreement than the 5-4 split would indicate. The majority, on the other hand, never engages with the question of whether it matters that the claim was brought under the 14th rather than the Fourth Amendment. The court managed to get a majority together that agreed in the application of the objective reasonableness standard and largely omitted any extended discussion of the deeper underlying basis for that decision. Practically speaking, the decision means that pretrial detainees asserting excessive force claims will be able to more easily get their case to trial and potentially to a favorable jury verdict. Proving the subjective intent of the officers would generally be difficult, and now the jury will be able to consider the objective reasonableness of the officer's conduct without having to consider what the officer actually intended. How the case law will develop further depends, at least in part, on the extent to which two issues raised in oral argument and in the majority opinion are significant to the justices. First, the oral argument and majority opinion call into question whether an objectively unreasonable use of force should ever be tolerated. Justice Sotomayor, in particular, appeared to be concerned about this issue during the oral argument. This concern could lead to changes in the Eighth Amendment jurisprudence as well, and the court hints at this when the majority mentions on page 12 of the slip opinion that the court's holding, quote, may raise questions about the use of a subjective standard in the context of excessive force claims brought by convicted prisoners, end quote. In light of that hint, it's probably advisable for jails and prisons to take this seriously and make sure that in their training and compliance reviews that the jailers are being instructed and acting in accordance with that objective standard and not assuming that they're going to have the benefit of the more favorable to them Eighth Amendment standard when they're dealing with convicted individuals. And while I think that's probably the advisable way to go, the other aspects of the oral argument and majority opinion indicate that it could be that the court's looking at a different distinction. The court also distinguishes between non-convicted individuals, which would include both those on the street, and pretrial detainees from convicted individuals. Justice Kagan in particular appeared to be interested in this distinction, and it is a distinction that was urged by Kingsley, and partly he urged it because it was in accordance with the prior case law. It also has the advantage of reflecting the fact that the Eighth Amendment appears to set a different standard than the Fourth or Fourteenth Amendments. If a majority of the court intends to retain the distinction between pretrial detainees and convicted individuals, then county jails may need to consider whether it would be better to segregate pretrial detainees from convicted individuals so as to avoid jailers inadvertently using the type of force permitted with incarcerated individuals on a pretrial detainee. How the law in this area will develop remains to be seen, but for Mr. Kingsley, he heads back down to the Court of Appeals for the lower court to consider some other arguments that were raised by the officers in support of the jury verdict in their favor, and whether he actually will end up getting a new trial, we will just have to see as the case develops.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.